Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're very pleased to welcome for the hour today Utah writer Terry Tempest Williams, of course, author of Finding Beauty in a Broken World, Refuge, and many other critically acclaimed books. Her new book, When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice. And Terry Tempest Williams will be doing a reading today at the University of Utah, the College of Nursing, and on Friday at Back of Beyond Books in Moab. Terry Tempest Williams, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Oh, doing well. I've been announcing this event at University of Utah for King's English Bookshop for the evening, but it looks like it's this morning.
It is. It's at 10:30.
10:30.
And it's at the College of Nursing. I really wanted to honor the women and men who give so much and in so many ways are invisible. So I'm looking forward to being there.
And unfortunately, your family has had more than its share, I guess we could say, of interaction with the medical profession.
We have, and it's the nurses that see us through. You know, I think anyone who has set foot into hospitals understand that, and they really are unsung heroes, and with the pay cuts that they're seeing, I just felt it was a wonderful opportunity to be able to say thank you.
So that's 10:30 today. So right after you're on with us, you'll be going over there. And Back of Beyond Books in Moab on Friday. That's in the evening at 7 o'clock. Moab, understand that area of the world, one of your favorite places.
I'm so excited to be home. So, yeah, it'll be great.
Yeah.
Just see friends, and Brooke and I are looking forward to that.
I wonder if you could, if you have your book with you, just to set this up, if you could read the brief opening chapter.
Of course, Tom. Thank you. I am 54 years old, the age my mother was when she died. This is what I remember. We were lying on her bed with a mohair blanket covering us. I was rubbing her back, feeling each vertebra with my fingers as I rung on a ladder. It was January, and the ruthless clamp of cold bore down on us outside. Yet inside, mother's tenderness and clarity of mind carried its own warmth. She was dying in the same way she was living, consciously. I'm leaving you all my journal, she said, facing the shuttered window as I continued rubbing her back, but you must promise me that you will not look at them until after I am gone. I gave her my word, and then she told me where they were. I didn't know my mother kept journals. A week later, she died. A month later, I found myself alone in the family home. I kept expecting mother to appear. It was the right time to read her journals. They were exactly where they said they would be. She said they would be. Three shelves of beautiful cloth-bound books, some floral, some paisley, others in solid colors. The spines of each were perfectly aligned against the lip of the shelves. I opened the first journal. It was empty. I opened the second journal. It was empty. I opened the third. It, too, was empty. As was the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, shelf after shelf after shelf. All my mother's journals were blank.
And you had not known that she kept journals before?
I did not. My mother was a very private woman. So, you know, it was a great surprise to me that she said, you know, I have three shelves full. And it was an incredibly shocking moment when I realized all of her journals were blank. And it was like a second death, honestly.
Yeah, I would imagine. What did you have in your mind in anticipation before you opened the journals?
You know, I was just so excited to finally know what my mother was thinking. You know, I think that in that month of her passing, you know, it was a great solace because I thought I will always have her words with me. But instead, it was her silences. And honestly, in that moment, I just gathered them all up after the shock of it, wondering what was she trying to say? Was this a cruel joke? Was it a generosity? Did she want me to fill them? was it an act of defiance? You know, Mormon women write. They write in journals. It was a total perplexing mystery. And what I can tell you, Tom, is I just gathered them up. I took them home, and I just, you know, through the years, wrote in them unceremoniously. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't deal with it, think about it, couldn't afford to emotionally, until I turned 54, the age my mother was when mm-hmm. she passed.
I was going to ask you why the wait, whether that was purposeful that you waited until 54, or just sort of happened that you were emotionally ready at that point?
You know, I think, I don't know about you, but I just buried it in the soles of my feet, and I think it was too painful. And then when I turned 54, you know, I think if you've lost a parent, particularly a mother, when you become the age where they died, it's a very, it's a sharp edge, and it was for me. And I think you come to grips with your own mortality, thinking, ah, this is how old she was. And honestly, I didn't realize how young she was, you know, and how vibrant and how much living she had ahead of her. So I think, I thought, okay, I can go back into this material now, not as a daughter, but as a woman, and begin asking questions I wouldn't have even known to ask when I was in my 20s.
Hmm. You write somewhere in the book that you wish your mother had known that you were a sister, not a daughter.
I think that's exactly the point I'm making, Tom.
Yeah.
And I think that if we live long enough, that really is the case.
Hmm. So you said you wrote in your mother's journals?
I did.
Hmm.
And, you know, nothing special, but just filled them.
Yeah.
I did notice as I was looking back that in each one, you know, I did say this is one of Mother's journals, but that was it.
And at some point, your goal became to try to discover her voice and rediscover your own voice?
Yes. You know, I think that When Women Were Birds became, how to say this? You know, it's definitely an autobiography of voice. What is voice? How do we find it, lose it, retrieve it, honor it, take care of it? But I think in the writing, and this is what I love, is you think you're going one direction and you find you go another. Otherwise, what's the point? And I thought I was writing a book about voice. I think, in truth, I may have written a book about silence.
Hmm. And the two are related.
They are.
Okay.
They are.
And
I think it's that notion, you know, how does silence nurture our voice? And also the paradox, what silences us? And I think most critically, how do we silence ourselves and why? What are we afraid of?
Mm-hmm. And it is fear, mostly fear, silences ourselves?
Well, when I think about when I silence myself, it's fear of retribution, fear of criticism, but then I think you reach a point where our silences no longer protect us.
Mm.
How about you?
Yeah.
I'm interested, you know, I'm speaking as a woman. Do you feel silenced at times?
Yes, and it is fear, I think, mostly. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And what are you afraid of?
I think some of what, and maybe this is more, you know, maybe this is a gender stereotype. I don't know what you think about this, but revealing too much of myself.
I think that's human, don't you?
Border between secrets and what you reveal. I guess that is human. Yes, definitely.
And I think you bring up another good point, which is also in the book, the notion of secrets. You know, my mother had secrets. I think we all carry secrets. And how does that impact our voice? And again, what we carry as human beings.
I guess some of this is about those borders between what we can know of each other and what we can't know, what we reveal and what we don't reveal. I assume that you knew quite a bit about your mother, and yet there's some that you don't know and can't know.
I think that's exactly right, and again, the paradox. You know, my mother and I were incredibly close, and I would have told you that I knew a great deal about my mother. Now I'm not so sure. You know, I think She loved mystery. And I think what I have come to understand with her journals, the difference between mystery and mysterious. You know, at first it was a mystery to be solved. Now I appreciate the mysterious nature of them, and it's something to be honored and to be celebrated. But in truth, we can never know another person's heart. And in that way, I think my mother gave me a great gift.
I wonder if you'd tell me a bit about your mother. You do describe your mother in the book. Growing up, you said she had an intensity about her. She was quieter than your father. And you kind of knew them in these ways. Your mother, your father is kind of a force of nature. If something needed to be done, wherever it was, that was him. But your mother was very strong and intense in her own way.
Right. We consider my father, still do, our action hero. My mother was a very graceful woman. She was, as I said, a private woman, not a silent one. She was also very wicked in her humor. And, you know, when my father turned 40, she wrapped all of his birthday presents in black. I remember her phone call one day said, "Would you like to go to New York? Lillian Hellman is, Little Foxes is playing Lillian Hellman's film." And I thought, I didn't know my mother loved Lillian Hellman. Well, it turns out that her favorite person on the planet, her hero, Elizabeth Taylor, was starring in it. They shared the same birthday, the same year. So I went, of course, we went back. We were in the middle of the play. It was divine. It was wonderful. It was reaching its dramatic climax. Elizabeth Taylor was mesmerizing, and my mother whispers, "We have to go." And I just went, "Are you kidding? The play isn't done. People were telling us to be quiet. It's New York." And the next thing I know, my mother is standing up, excusing herself. I follow. We get onto the street. And I just said, "What is going on?" And she said, "Elizabeth Taylor comes to Sardi's after the play. I want to be here to see her." And sure enough, on, right as clockwork, Elizabeth Taylor walks in with her purple caftan, her jewels. My mother's sitting on this settee in the parlor, and as Miss Taylor goes to walk by, my mother trips her. And Miss Taylor says, "Oh, please forgive me." And my mother says, "Not at all." And they have a conversation. You know, that's who my mother was. She was the deepest person I know, and at times also the most shallow.
That's quite a woman.
And the other thing, Tom, what I can tell you about my mother, she was diagnosed with breast cancer at 38 with four children. And every night, my mother quietly would watch the sun set over Great Salt Lake and quietly applaud.
Yeah, that's a glimpse into her inner being. I wonder, you also write in the book that especially women tend to, I don't know how to phrase this, subsume their wants, their needs in the needs of those around them.
I think that's true.
And it's certainly true for your mother?
It's certainly true. It was certainly true with my mother. I think that's what we do as women. Relationships come first. I know as a writer, people say, "Do you write every day?" No, I don't know any woman that has that luxury. Our relationships come first, at least for me and for most of the women that I know.
You have several touching letters from your mother to you throughout the book. One of those, I'm thinking in this context, she wrote to you on the eve of your wedding to your husband, and she's telling you about marriage and some advice, which I thought was extraordinary.
Yeah, I love, her letters they continue to be like water to me, and I take them in deeply. I love that she wrote me the letter and just said, keep it alive. Keep it mysterious. Keep it full of adventures, and honor your own solitude. And I think Brooke and I have kept those words close. It also, Tom, I put that letter in the context of what precedes it, which is this idea of Nushu script, that among a certain population of Chinese women, they held a secret language, and the script itself looks like bird tracks on snow, and it's not square like most Chinese characters, but more linear. And this was a language that women spoke to each other when there was no one there to correct them. And that on the eve of a bride's wedding, the mother and the women would write to their daughters about the advice upon marriage. And I thought, you know, we're not so different. My mother did the same thing for me. It just wasn't in Nushu script. It wasn't in a black book, but in a beautiful letter in her own script.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Utah writer Terry Tempest Williams. Her latest book is When Women Were Birds. She's examining the mystery of her mother's blank journals and what it means to have a voice. And shortly this morning, she'll be doing a reading at University of Utah, the College of Nursing there, sponsored by King's English Bookshop. That's at 10:30 this morning. And on Friday at 7 o'clock at Back of Beyond Books in Moab, another reading for people in the Moab area. You're welcome to join the conversation here if you would like at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or email us at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well. The title, I wonder if you could talk a bit about the title. There are birds all the way, bird imagery all the way through the book, When Women Were Birds.
There's irony in the title. Most birds that sing are male. And so I pondered, you know, I thought about when women were birds, what did our voices sound like? There's also, you know, the metaphor of birds in cages, and there's lots of references in literature to that ascribed to women. But I think more importantly, Tom, I'll read you the last paragraph of the book. Once upon a time, when women were birds, there was the simple understanding that to sing at dawn and to sing at dusk was to heal the world through joy. The birds still remember what we have forgotten, that the world is meant to be celebrated.
So we've forgotten.
And I think this is a remembering, and it's not something that, oh, voila, I have a voice, but it's something that I think I struggle with daily, but how do we find that strength to speak what is in our hearts? And I love that idea that if we fail in this century, it is because we are afraid, and I think now more than ever, for both women and men, it is crucial that we speak out and speak on behalf of the things that matter most to us. I mean, if we just think about in terms of democracy, democracy works only if we have a voice, and many voices acquire a chorus of voices.
And especially crucial now because the stakes are so high? Is that what you're saying?
I think the stakes are high. Mm-hmm. Whether it's climate change, whether it's in our own state of Utah regarding public lands, whether it's health care, whether it's women's health issues, I think it's absolutely essential that we speak. I know it's important for us as women to speak up in our own families. I'm amazed at how much I don't say, which would surprise some people and wish that I was quieter, but I just think it's about conversation, and everything turns on that. Can we speak to each other in a language that opens our hearts rather than closes them? And I think that's the other thing. We've been talking about voice. We've been talking about the counterbalance of silence. I think we can also add to that the power of listening, deep listening.
Part of your book, this is chapter 41, you write about how you were transformed by a night in jail. I wonder if you'd tell us about that.
Right. Not for a noble cause. It wasn't about war. It wasn't about stopping nuclear testing. It wasn't, you know, I think about Tim DeChristopher and his heroic act of his protest of oil and gas leases. I spent a night in jail, 36 hours actually, because I was speeding. I was going 48 miles in a 35 mile per hour zone in Soda Springs, Idaho. And I would say it was about sloppy living. I also did not realize I was driving with an expired driver's license. So nothing heroic here. I called Brooke. He was in Wyoming. We didn't have enough money in our checking account to pay bail. And I thought, how bad can one night in jail be? And you promise you'll pick me up in the next day. He had a commitment that night. It was grim. And talk about silences and shadows and having no clue what goes on behind not just closed doors, but bars. These women were largely under 30. They were young Mormon women who were addicted to crystal meth. Their husbands, boyfriends were working in the oil and gas industry on the patches in Wyoming. Heartbreaking stories. And the women wanted to tell them. And they were giving out recipes on how to create crystal meth as though they were their mother's or grandmother's recipes on brownies. And they didn't know when they were going to get out. They didn't know if once they were in the system, they would always be in the system. You know, I was in a privileged position. I knew I was going to get out. And I think about them every day, Tom. Mm. And it was deeply humbling. Once you put on that orange suit and you are shackled around your wrists and waist and ankles, you're neutralized pretty fast. And I realized, you know, they may be in there for speed. I was also in jail because of speed of a different nature with a different addiction.
And how do you feel that transformed you? How are you different coming out of that experience?
That's such a good question. Again, realizing how privileged I am, the resources that I have, again, the voice. B, there's really very little difference in those who are in jail and those of us who are not, and it's about luck. I think about the justice system, one of retribution that has very little to do with restoration, and I think a lot about restorative justice and what that might look like. 2 million people in this country are incarcerated. So, I guess I'm very mindful in a very visceral way of what injustice looks like, feels like. And I can tell you, it's ugly. And the favors that were traded at night between the guards and the women, the drugs that were given and trades for sexual favors, nothing to read, no exercise to be had. You know, I think that our county jails are really, really dark places.
I don't know if it was this experience or another occasion. You write very moving in the book. This stuck with me about women who would hold their own fingers, imagining children who they had born and then given up for adoption.
Absolutely. I remember the woman next to the bunk. It was a pod, an open space, very small space actually, with six bunk beds. There were 13 of us. There was another bunk bed stray. And at night, this one woman who had just given birth and had to give her son up for adoption at night, she would sing a lullaby holding her finger as though it were her child's, holding her.
Yeah, heartbreaking. She doesn't know, of course, where this child, potentially where this child has gone, and doesn't know when she'll be out.
No.
Yeah.
And every one of those women, you know, had stories like that. I remember sentences. What we had in common was the color orange. We were all wearing it. And one woman said, "Why do I hate the color orange when red and yellow are my favorite colors?"
Hmm. Yeah.
Most of them, you know, and some of them were in because of just bad luck again, you know. Hmm. Life, it's so precarious. I think about that a lot.
Freedom and imprisonment, the themes that run through this book as well. And I want to relate this with, you did an interview with Tim DeChristopher in Orion Magazine, and I was struck by several passages from that. Of course, he's in federal prison for a couple of years for his actions. Those who agree with his actions see it as activism. Of course, those opposed, I guess, see this as a just sentence. And in this interchange with Tim DeChristopher, you talk about how each has to find their own path to activism, the name of the community. And you talk about the challenge you heard from Tim to Christopher was what's most uncomfortable, the most uncomfortable thing you can do, the greatest risk with the most at stake. Is that what you think about? Is what people who are, want to get into this arena, that's what they should do?
You know, I think it's very important for people to know their gifts and their strengths. And, you know, for Tim, it was committing civil disobedience and risking going to jail, which he is now in prison. That is his path. That was his strength, and that was his calling, and his choice. You know, that's not for everyone. There are those who have children. You know, jail is not an option for them. There are those who have jobs. Jail is not an option for them, or civil disobedience. And that's where I was challenging Tim and saying, you know, each of us can contribute to the open space of democracy in our own way, with the gifts that are ours, each in our own time. And I think that's what self-knowledge is about, knowing what one can do and what one can't do. I think where Tim's point was so well taken is where's that comfort line, and what are we willing to risk? And I think risk is the key word there. And, you know, when he asked me, you know, what is your risk? For me, my risk is in speaking. You know, every time I have to speak, I am physically ill. It terrifies me. But there's something beyond that terror, and that is, you know, trying to make a difference in the world. I write. That's what I do. You know, other people have other strengths and other gifts. I look at my father. My father, you know, has committed himself to higher education and scholarships and working on that level. You know, I look at my niece. Her gift is teaching. She's working in a very diverse school in Salt Lake City, and she's working with at-risk girls. So I think each person contributes in their own way.
We are going to take a brief break, and we'll be back with Terry Tempest Williams. We're talking about her new book, When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice. When her mother was dying, Terry Tempest Williams' mother told her, "I'm leaving you all my journals. Promise me you won't look at them until after I've gone." And when she went to open them up, three shelves immaculately stacked of journals, all empty. And when she herself was approaching 54, the age their mother died, Terry Tempest Williams has written this book, Meditation on What Does It Mean to Have a Voice, and many other important questions. Terry Tempest Williams will be at University of Utah, an event for the King's English Bookshop. That's at the College of Nursing, and that's at 10:30, about an hour away now. And then at Back of Beyond Books in Moab on Friday evening at 7 o'clock. We have a Steve Eaton commentary, and we'll be back after this brief break.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Logan Summerfest Arts Fair this Thursday through Saturday, featuring music by Ryan Shoup and the Rubber Band, Saturday at 7 p.m., playing a wide range of instruments and musical styles. Information at logansummerfest.com.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
What is that? What does it do? Can I eat it? Why are you doing that? Why did you close that door? Can you lay on your back like this? Look at how much pee-pee I saved up just for you. Oh, let's eat this thing. It smells awful. Why are you doing that? Let's go outside. I can pick this up and run away. I never, ever poop on your lawn or anywhere outside. Am I a good boy? What is this? Oh, let's pull it off the table to see if it's food. Can a dog climb completely inside a refrigerator? I can. Don't you love me? I love everything. Let's jump on the bed. I did it first, so the bed is mine. I think I'll go lick that pillow. This is my life right now. I have said, okay, time to go potty, so many times in the last 48 hours that I'm afraid I'll say it in my sleep or start to mumble it out loud in a work meeting without realizing it. We had a dog for nearly 17 years. 3 days after my dog was married, our dog, Calista, lay down and just couldn't get up again. She was gray, old, and very tired. She raised our two kids last April, and she decided that it was time to go. We were surprised at how much crying we could do over a single dog, one that never learned to give us back rubs or fetch the newspaper. There was an awful void. Something important was missing. As it turns out, there are very few people who will give you the kind of unconditional love that a dog will offer you. I've never had a boss jump up and down and run around in circles every time he or she saw me. Some have made me run around in circles, but that's not the same thing. I once saw an embroidered pillow in someone's house that said, "I want to be the kind of person that my dog thinks I am." We miss that kind of respect and unconditional love, so we went out and did something we never thought we'd do. We got another dog. We got another Basenji, a breed of dog you don't see every day on the street. Rarely will you find them on a doggy calendar. We picked this breed because my wife is allergic to dogs, but not to Basenjis. They're very clean dogs, and I suspect they'd vacuum and clean our carpets and scrub the floors if they didn't think it would be easier to train us to do such chores. The clean instinct apparently doesn't apply to the puppy stage, especially if a puppy has decided it's much more private to go potty in the house than outside. Basenjis are known for being intelligent animals who prefer to train their owners. Of course, we aren't letting our new dog Sundance train us, but we have to adjust our behavior a little. For example, I've already learned that if I leave my socks on the ground, Sundance will grab them and fling them up in the air until my wife notices and yells at me. I put them away now. It's been a long time since we had a puppy, and our new Basenji thinks that just about everything that happens is reason to celebrate. There is no past, and there is no future with Sundance, just the glorious now, and clearly now is a moment made for playing and chewing. I've wondered how it would be if our presidential candidates had a little less bulldog and a little more puppy in them. Envision this. President Obama, Mitt Romney says you're wrecking the economy. Then President Obama would just lower his head and go back in the White House and sulk. Or can you imagine this? A birther is backstage scolding a happy, relaxed Mitt Romney, insisting that he drop a sock from his mouth before he go on stage. "Mitt, let it go. Drop it. It will make you look foolish," the birther would say. Or imagine President Obama involved in a tug-of-war with a rope toy and a particularly ornery member of Congress. Picture ops on the evening news would look much different that way. You can insert your own congressional lapdog joke here. Wouldn't it be cool and disorienting if our drones dropped tons of squeaky toys on terrorists instead of bombs? They could drop the bombs later if it was necessary. It would just be fun to see them rained upon with squeaky toys. For now, most of you will have to push ahead in this cold, cruel world with just your imagination and the hope of a better day. Not me. I've got a happy, joyous dog to train. But not right now. Right now, I think it's time to race down the hall and jump on the bed. I just need to pick up my socks first. This is Steve Eaton.
Thanks for staying with us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Terry Tempest Williams, Utah writer, of course, author of acclaimed books such as Refuge and Finding Beauty in a Broken World. Her new book is When Women Were Birds, and it's Meditations on Voice, a response to her mother's blank journals. What does it mean to have a voice? And there are many themes in the book. It's getting great reviews, and we're pleased to be talking with Terry Tempest Williams on the program today. A little less than an hour from now at the University of Utah at the College of Nursing, there, sponsored by King's English Bookshop. Terry Tempest Williams will be giving a reading and book signing there. So if you're in that area, that's at 10:30 today. Then on Friday evening at 7 o'clock, back of Beyond Books in Moab, the site of the next reading and book signing, at least for Utah. I believe, Terry Tempest Williams, you're on tour. You're going various places.
I am. I've been home for a bit, and now have the opportunity of visiting different places in the West that I love, so no complaints.
I was going to ask you if you enjoy this. I guess you say public speaking, a big fear. This, I don't know about readings. Is that okay for you?
You know, I'm always terrified, but so it goes, right?
I guess so, yeah.
I read where public speaking is the number one fear in people, and I'm right there with them. But, you know, once you get going, then you forget, and, it's a privilege to be able to share these ideas, and it's been really fascinating hearing people's comments about their own journals, their own sense of voice and silence. And so, you know, I think the most we can hope for is to create a conversation. Mm. I have to tell you, I loved the commentary by Steve Irwin about, is that?
Steve Eaton, yes.
Steve Eaton,
yes.
About the Basenjis. We have a Basenji, so my mind is with Rio.
Wonderful. With your own Basenji.
Exactly. And, yes. You know, they're supposed to be quiet dogs. They're barkless. But since we're talking about voice, I think Basenjis have the most wild, wonderful, unpredictable voices. Rio sings, howls with Mozart's Requiem. Or Janis Joplin. He has a wide range of
that
commentary.
Is,
anyway, yeah. My mind is with dogs right now.
That is a wide range. That's an eclectic dog. Yeah. I was reading an author snapshot. This kind of gave me a little insight into you from the reading room. Your favorite author, you list several, but Walt Whitman's head of that list.
I love Whitman, don't you?
Well, yes. Yeah, certainly. Why Whitman?
If there's one person I could meet, I love his lists. I love his passion. I love how close his ear is to the ground, you know, in something like Song of Myself. I love his work with the soldiers, you know, how in Washington, D.C., you know, he sat by the dying soldiers' side and wrote letters for them. I love that he loved Lincoln. I think he's a great American voice that continues to be as relevant as any writer today.
Hmm. By the way, in this survey, you had a 20 questions, you had your own, and you get in your favorite word, petrichor. Am I saying that correct? Correctly?
Yeah, I think it's such a beautiful word, the smell of rain before it falls.
Hmm. Yeah, that is a beautiful image.
And the desert, you know, whenever you walk outside or if you're out walking and you get that smell, you know rain is coming. And to me, it's that essence of hope in times of drought. And I think it's a beautiful word.
You write quite a bit in this book about water and desert, I guess the absence of water. Some of your earliest and fondest memories are at the ocean.
Yes, I was born in Riverside, California, and my father was in the service in the Air Force, and my mother would take me to the beach almost every day, and I think that memory remains. And even though we live in the desert, you know, to live in the desert is to have a mind of water. And I think about that.
And you love both.
Absolutely. And again, absence is presence, presence mm-hmm. is absence. That dialectic, that dance. And, you know, living in the desert, it was once covered with water, and you feel that. In the same way, you know, when you're at the ocean, I'm very mindful of aridity. You know, again, it's memory. It's what we hold in our bodies.
Another factor, you write, when you were young, you came to know early that what you love can hurt you. You know, the waves would knock you down. So there's a duality as well that you, I guess, had present from very young age.
Right, and you get up. You're knocked down, you get up, you're knocked down, you get up. You run, you move back in toward the wave. I think the ocean is so compelling, and I think we feel that our origins are there. And walking the rack line every morning, high tide, low tide, and the surprises that await us. I think there's so many metaphors for our own lives.
Three adjectives that best describe you, and I want to launch into some of your family again. You say intense, passionate, and present. And it's that present that's hard to do, isn't it? To be intense
and
present?
My mother gave us that gift. You know, as I said, at 38, being diagnosed with breast cancer, a very aggressive breast cancer, she took nothing for granted, and therefore neither did we. And when my mother was with you, she was completely present. You were the only person in the room. Her eyes, her ears, My grandmother also had that gift. And I think that's all we have. And, you know, I know in my own situation, recently I was diagnosed with a tangle in my brain. And one of the options is surgery, and I chose not to take that option because of the risk factors. And I remember the surgeon, the neurologist saying, how well do you live with uncertainty? And my response was, what else is there? And I believe that, and that's a gift that my mother gave me.
I believe one of the possible outcomes with this would be literal silence. Am I right in that? You wouldn't be able to speak if a certain outcome came about.
That's correct. You know, where this sits on my brain is in the Wernicke part of the brain that oversees language, pattern thinking, metaphor, all the things that you and I care about. But I've watched members in my family live with cancer and die from cancer, and that is life, and there's no exceptions. And so I think the challenge we have is how to live in the present gracefully, because none of us know what lies ahead.
There's a chapter, maybe I'll have you recount this story, but it talks about this, that you say the women in your family have this gift, and you talk about it going to a party, I think a family party, and an aunt of yours, I believe it is, and you ascribe that gift to her, that she's very present. When she's talking to you, it's you're very present before her.
Right.
But you come away conflicted. What she wants is for you to join the rest of the women in the family and have babies. She glances at your flat stomach and
the once flat stomach, right?
Yes. And at the time, you have this idea that's going to become refuge.
You know, we live in a culture of a dominant religion, and I grew up Mormon, and I'm no longer Orthodox, and that carries its own stresses, growing pains, I would say even scars. You know, I don't think we ever escape our conditioning, nor do we want to. But it's not easy to break set. And I think that as a writer, if you're going to attempt to be honest with your own feelings or point of view, you're going to offend certain people. And I have certainly done that, beginning with refuge. And it's not easy to write about family. My family has put up with a lot from me, and I am eternally grateful. But nevertheless, it's important for me to ask questions and tough questions. And yes, my Aunt Bee, you know, did not understand what I was attempting to do, writing a book about the rise of Great Salt Lake and the death of Mother. And I thought I was crazy, thinking maybe there is no relationship with the two. But I tell the story of going home, pulling out this childhood easel, taking two pens in two hands, and writing Mother, Mormon Church, cancer on one side, writing Great Salt Lake, Bird Refuge on the other, circling both, seeing that there was nothing to connect them. I drew two lines down and wrote narrator, TTW, circled that, and standing back from afar, I realized I had drawn a map of the female reproductive organs, and I thought, I can do this. I'm really writing from that place of what we know as women from our bodies, and that gave me tremendous courage. And if courage can be defined as sustained focus, then I think that's what it takes to write out of the truth of our lives.
Then you ended up in a Kinko's and ran into Mark Strand.
I did. I
of had all
my
people.
Nightgown at that point. I stuffed it in to my Levi's as I put them on. My cowboy boots, tore down Immigration Canyon, went into Kinko's. I had pulled everything out that had to do with Mother and my family, and I wanted it printed in the brightest paper possible. It was 2 in the morning. The woman behind the counter said, you might not be able to read it. I said, it doesn't matter. In walks Mark Strand. He looked worse than I did. And I thought, I cannot believe she's going to hand me back a bright turquoise manuscript, and he's going to see it. And I looked at Mark, and I just said, are there days where you feel like you cannot write one more word? And at that moment, Tom, he could have slayed me. And he looked at me, and he said, every single day. She handed me the manuscript. He didn't even notice. I left. I recalibrated the manuscript, realizing there was too much white here, too intense about birds, too much blue here, too much intense about family. My task was to create a light blue manuscript where these two stories were integrated. So I have Aunt Bee to thank for that, and Mark Strand to keep me going.
Yes. If you just joined us, we're talking with Terry Tempest Williams on Access Utah today. There is an event coming up this morning. It's about a half an hour away, 10:30, at the College of Nursing at the University of Utah. And Terry Tempest Williams will be giving doing a reading and book signing on her latest book, When Women Were Birds. And then at on Friday, 7 o'clock in the evening, back of Beyond Books in Moab, there's another opportunity for you, signing and a reading and signing. I was, as an opera buff, I was very pleased to discover, I think it's chapter 52, an experience you and your father had going to the opera.
I love opera, don't you, Tom?
I'd love it, love it. You talk about a very moving experience at in Der Rosenkavalier. It's a comic opera, but there are melancholy moments. And then especially you and your father went to Die Frau ohne Schatten, Strauss's The Woman Without a Shadow. Light and shadow are another theme that runs through the book.
I appreciate your careful reading. I just want to say that to you. Thank you.
Thank you. You say we as women exist in direct sunlight only. What if we talk about that?
I was saying that that's a myth.
That's the myth, yes.
That we exist in sunshine only. You know, I think there's this myth that, how are you? Great, everything's perfect. Not true. And if we don't dwell in the shadows and acknowledge them, embrace them, we will continue to project on others, which wreaks havoc. I love the opera, The Woman Without a Shadow, because it addresses those issues. And I love that my father went with me. It's known, as you know, as the Mount Everest of operas. It's 4 hours long. It's a fairy tale. It's difficult. And my father said, I'm happy to go with you as long as it has a halftime. And I said, there's actually two. But it's a beautiful story about how we, and actually in this case, it's that we gain our shadows through our children. And I think that's very true.
Mm-hmm. I wonder,
our children bring us to our knees, no matter what age they come to us.
And so that's monumental as you contemplate, I guess, possibility of having a child.
You know, Brooke and I are childless by choice. However, at 50, I became a mother. We adopted Louis Kakumba. It's complex. It's exquisite. It's unorthodox. For Brooke and me, and for Louis as well, it's a redefinition of family. I'm not his mother. He has a mother. Brooke is not his father, but it is a reconfiguration of what family looks like. He was my translator in Rwanda. He came to the United States at 24. I met him at 21. He's now 30, and he's changed our lives. And he's also brought me to my knees. It's deeply humbling, but I would not be the person that I am, and I think Louis has certainly shown me my shadow. And yet, that's where the joy is as well. So again, these beautiful gifts of life that we could never anticipate, that bring us to our voice, that allow us to enter that space of silence and deep listening and to grow as human beings. And I don't know what else matters more than that.
I wonder if you would read page 161 for us. This is at the end of this experience with your father and the opera. And I think you're right, you were both very moved.
My father, we were both standing side by side in rapturous applause. My father loved it as well. Where would you, it's on 161?
161, yeah. I don't have the book in front of me. I just have an e-book, which I don't have on this computer, but I believe it's 161.
I think the e-book is different.
Oh, okay.
So if you could give me the passage.
This would be after the opera has ended, and your father and you are reacting to the opera. And then he talks about how he has reacted to the death of your mother.
Okay. Let me see. My father was equally moved. During one of the intermissions, he told me in a rare moment that because of the power of mother's presence, he rarely spoke. No need. She covered for him. It was not until after her death that he really began to engage socially. People tell me I've become much more gregarious since Diane died, he said. I am much more involved with our friends now. He paused. I've learned a lot from living alone. When I hear that someone has lost a spouse or child, the next day I just knock on their door. It doesn't matter what I say. What matters is I'm there.
Very moving. And as I read early in the book, it surprised me that he became more gregarious because it seemed like he was such a force of nature. But I think that's a point. That's what I hear. I thankfully haven't experienced death really close to me, but that's what I hear from other people is just being there. Just being there is the point.
And it goes back to, I think, the theme of this conversation, Tom, the power of presence. That, and again, where I thought I was writing a book about voice, what we say, I think it's more about what we do and what we feel. And sometimes that does mean silence. But I think that what we're really talking about is presence. Being present with one another, being present with the land, being present with our sorrow, being present with our joy.
And so all of those things are connected to voice?
And I think that, you know, the emptiness of my mother's journals, who would have ever imagined? And I feel deeply grateful that she knew me well enough that 25 years later, I would be possessed with the gift that she gave me when I was a woman barely 30. That now, as a woman 56 years old, she allowed me to contemplate emptiness in the fullest way. That my mother's journals tell me nothing. My mother's journals tell me everything.
And you write at the end, my mother's gift is the mystery. Each day I begin with the empty page. And I suppose that's the way with all of us.
Indeed.
Yeah. We are out of time. The book is When Women Were Birds. It's Terry Tempest Williams' reaction to her mother's empty journals. And what does it mean to have a voice? And she'll be doing a couple of readings. One is just half an hour away now. That's at the College of Nursing, University of Utah campus, sponsored by King's English Bookshop. That's at 10:30. And then Friday night at 7, back of Beyond Books in Moab is the setting. That's on Friday.
Tom, thank you so much. I so appreciate the depth of this conversation, and thank you for your voice for all of us here in Utah.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate it. And coming up tomorrow, by the way, I hope you'll tune in. We'll talk about wildfires. Unfortunately, all over the West now, and in places in Utah, we're experiencing that. We'll be talking with Professor Stephen Pine from Arizona State University. He's done history of fire in America. Mike Coons from USU, a forestry expert, and some Wayne County residents. They have a fire right in their back door. That's coming up tomorrow. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.